Talking Joe is on the air.
And it's Skybound, the Walking Dead guy. Everyone calm down, it's the invincible Bat Skybound.
It's me, Mark, coming to you live and direct from the Energon universe. If you are new to the show, you can find out all of the details over at our website, talkingjoe.co.uk. Today on Talking Joe, we will be looking at Duke issues 2 and 3, which were released February and March 2024. And joining me, as always, it's everyone's favourite Australian one-eyed mercenary, it's Tim Finn.
Oh, you set me up. I didn't have my Major Blood impression ready. Hello, listeners, and hello, Mark. And I will get back to my Major Blood impression later.
Okay. So what's going on in the wide world of G.I. Joe? Actually, Tim, before we get started, there's some exciting news, which is actually alluded to in the back of Duke issue 3. Which
I thought you might lead with this.
All about Skybound's reprint program. And on the same day that we found on the Diamond Previews catalogue that the compendium number 1 was solicited at $65, coming out in October, containing 50 issues. At the same time, in the back of Duke issue 3, editor Sean Makowitz says that they are announcing that Skybound is republishing Larry Hama & Co.'s Real American Hero in compendium format starting this fall. We are starting with the original Marvel run and reprinting everything, in capital letters, in order for the most complete G.I. Joe reading experience possible. So compendium is like Skybound's omnibus format. It's a floppy, non-hardcover, fairly bare-bones reprint, which typically is about 50 issues, and they've got various compendiums, including Kirkman's biggest hits, like Walking Dead, Invincible, Oblivion Song, and Outcast. And I've read quite a lot of content in that format, and it works for me. It's a good way of getting a lot of content for good value. So it's very exciting. And the most exciting about this letter is everything in capital letters.
Mark used the word floppy, and just to slightly clarify, since some people call single issues floppies, which I consider kind of a derogatory, these several hundred page soft covers are technically floppy as an adjective, in that they're not hard covers, but they're big and heavy and substantial. And I don't know about every comic book store, but I know that my comic book store has had good success with many of them. ElfQuest, Fables, Walking Dead, Invincible, occasionally Spawn. And what's great about them, for fans who were collecting IDW's various series collections of the Hama G.I. Joe, there's Classic G.I. Joe, there's the sort of just numbered A Real American Hero, and they're the complete collection hardcovers that were oversized and initially $50. This might be, a disappointment because the next publisher isn't continuing with that format. I do understand that that's disappointing, considering that this could bring in many fans who weren't getting G.I. Joe reprints 10 years ago, and they would want to start with the first issues. And as Mark just said, yes, $64.99 is a lot of money for a single book, but the bigger these books are, the less you pay per page.
Yeah.
And it is a commitment to sit with this, £2 book on your lap. But I've been imagining the last couple of weeks, the entire Marvel run by Hama could be in 4 compendia. You could do 1 through 50 roughly in the first one, and I'm going to send an email making this request. And then you could mix in special missions. You could alternate between special missions and the main book for the next couple of years. So a volume 2 would have, I don't know, you know, 51 through 80 and most of special missions. Because special missions 6, I really want that to fall after issue 61, because that does continue the story in a different direction. And then similarly, special missions 27 continues into issue 92. Or is it the other way around? And though I think having a separate collection for all of special missions is neat, because it's a different book with a different feel, and it's also nice in a different way to, you know, have Larry Hama and Herb Trimpe, who drew almost every issue of Special Missions. I do think that a like 3-volume Real American Hero without Special Missions is going to sell pretty well. And a Special Missions Volume 1 complete by itself compendium is going to get sort of overlooked. And I would rather that get incorporated and then make the sort of total number of compendia 1 more. Also, it is important to me that yearbooks 2, 3, and 4 get printed where they fall in their publication order. The story in yearbook 2 can actually happen almost anywhere, but the story in yearbook 3 definitely takes place at a certain point because of who is rescued. And I don't want, you know, it made all kinds of sense for IDW to do a little softcover with the 4 yearbooks by themselves. But I don't think that makes sense in terms of being a reader of G.I. Joe. And I very much appreciate how Marvel, with its epic collections, its, you know, 400-page, 500-page softcovers, how it includes sort of chronologically everything that was happening. You get a chunk of issues of, say, Wolverine, but also what Wolverine was doing in Marvel Comics Presents and a special at the time. Okay, yeah. Enough of that.
The other news that we've not talked about on any of these episodes is Energon Universe news, which is that there's an Energon Universe special, which weirdly is going to get released twice, once as a free comic book day special on May the 4th, and then again the following week on May the 8th as a special again, but this time rather than it being free or close to free, it's $3.99 with a brand new cover by Daniel Warren Johnson. So it's a bit strange that they're double dipping, but there some people I know can struggle to get hold of the free comic book day comics, so anyway, I guess that is able to get in people's hands is probably a great thing.
So if you don't have a comic book store near you, it is possible that your local library takes part in Free Comic Book Day. As for Skybound double dipping, Marvel has done this. Marvel did this past year, where their like Spider-Man, X-Men Free Comic Book Day was released again for like $6 a couple weeks later with the very cool and slightly overbaked title Marvel Zero, which I feel like should have been saved for something else with a new cover. You know, you may get to your comic book store and they may participate in Free Comic Book Day, but I got to tell you folks, looking at the catalogs, not just Diamond Previews, but also Lunar for DC and Penguin Random House for Marvel, there are a lot of Free Comic Book Day comics to choose from, and also some merch like Hero Clicks and t-shirts. And my store does not carry every Free Comic Book Day comic. And you might think, but they're free. Well, you know, they're 25 or 45 cents each for my store, so they're not free. And we have to do a little math on sort of which ones that we think will not just get people excited when they come in on Free Comic Book Day, but maybe bring them back to buy things, to, you know, read more stories. And so it's fun to just give away a variety of free stuff, but, you know, some of the titles don't have a lot of traction otherwise in our store, and we feel like wouldn't move the needle after Free Comic Book Day. So you may go to your local store and they may not have carried the Energon Universe special on Free Comic Book Day. Or maybe they, you know, they got some and they ran out. And so this is an opportunity for you to ask your store to order it for you, and then you can pay them, which they like, or they can just sell a thing all over again to completists. I'm really excited. The last 10 years when IDW chose G.I. Joe and or Transformers as the thing that it would publish on Free Comic Book Day, you know, not Ninja Turtles or, you know, Dungeons and Dragons or some of its creator-owned stuff. I always thought, yes, we're special. So it's nice to have that again.
Mm. And so the actual book itself, they've been touting that there might be a little bit of a Megatron reveal that they've been building up to. So it's written by Robert Kirkman, obviously Void Rivals, Daniel Warren Johnson, Transformers, Joshua Williamson, who is also the G.I. Joe regular writer. Artists are Lorenzo DeFelici, obviously that's going to be Void Rivals, Ryan Ottley, who is drawing Transformers. Ryan Ottley on Transformers, that's pretty cool. That's Ryan Ottley of Invincible fame, with the third artist being Jason Howard. So by process of elimination, it looks like Jason Howard is going to be drawing G.I. Joe for this special. And I don't know if we can read anything more into that or not, but if I was a betting man,
he has been drawing some second print covers.
Yeah, he's been drawing the second print cover. So he's drawn a lot of covers for the Energon universe. And so, yeah, they haven't said explicitly what the G.I. Joe story is, but it will be very interesting to find out. In May, I think we are seeing issue 5 of Cobra Commander, the last issue of Cobra Commander. The previous month will be the last issue of Duke, and we are expecting there to be 2 more minis before the big G.I. Joe title starts as an ongoing. So before too very long, we'll probably find out what the next 2 minis might be.
I'm going to guess one of them is Baroness.
Hmm. It's a fair bet. Second guess?
Destro?
Hmm. Yeah. I mean, in the odds, I think those 2 would be in there. I think it will definitely be one of the... I think we'll probably have another G.I. Joe and another Cobra, and it's likely to be one of the heavy hitters. So G.I. Joe, my best guess at the moment is Hawk, so that we might see a little bit of Duke's story, but maybe from a different angle. So Duke's on the sort of the renegade, you know, conspiracy theory type route. And maybe we'll see a similar sort of a kind of a different angle of that story from the person in the system and in the know as to what's going on. If not Hawk, my second bet would be Scarlet. And then on the Cobra side, yeah, Destro seems like a good bet. If not Destro, Baroness. Zartan is an out there outsider, but yeah. Mm. I think between those names, we probably got them. Right. Okay, news and speculation aside, let's talk about Duke 2 and 3. It comes to us from the creative team of writer Joshua Williamson, artist Tom Riley, colorist Jordi Belair, letterer Russ Wooten, editors Sean Makowitz and Jonathan Manning, logo and publication design Andre Juarez, and production Gillian Crabb.
Let's have a look at the covers in the gallery.
We've got a fair few covers. I'm counting 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10 across the 2 issues. Do you want to give us a whistle-stop tour, Tim?
Yeah. Duke cover A is Tom Riley. Duke is being held by some masked, tough security guards with nightsticks and taser weapons. It's nice. It's a sort of a some brightness in the center of some darkness because of Duke's complexion, his hair, his shirt, whereas all the armor on these masked guys around him is much darker. Duke number 2 cover B is a really striking drawing by Ricardo Lopez Ortiz. This is one of my favorite covers of the year. Mm. And I know we're not too far into the year. There is a Jason Pearson and Michael Golden quality to the cartooning, to the slight fisheye lens, the curvilinear perspective mm-hmm. of this cover. So Duke is driving a vehicle. It's a little unusual in that he's facing left. Many covers in Western comics, characters are facing to the right. With his left hand braced, he's turning the wheel. With his right hand, he's holding a pistol, gritted teeth. But the slightly cartoony eye and size of his mouth says, you know, an artist like those two who exaggerate in cartoon. The color in this cover looks a little bit like animation cell shading. There are speed lines. It's just very, very exciting. For the variants, 1 in 10, 1 in 25, and 1 in 50, that's Tyler Boss drawing Ako or Ako, who did a Nick Fury miniseries for Marvel a couple years ago, and then Nick Dragotta. The Tyler Boss cover to number 2 connects with the cover to 1 and also 3. In this one, Duke and Clutch are driving in what looks like a demolition derby, actually, in a sort of, how do you describe this car? It's got a crazy paint job on it with flame and like teeth.
Yeah, like Tiger Force teeth almost.
It's got like a cage as the rear windshield. They're getting shot at. There are some stadium lights up in the distance, and they're driving sort of through a junkyard on a sort of irregularly paved track. But the other three cars they're racing against doesn't look like, you know, Cobra or bad guys. The Ako or Ako cover is matches the previous Steve Epting covers for issue 1, where it's a character, in this case, Stalker, with the explosion from the original toy packaging behind him. Nick Dragotta's got Rock and Roll and Stalker blasting past us in a junkyard with lots of cars behind them. They're illuminated by their weapons. It's sort of purplish nighttime behind them. Dragotta is an artist who I feel like is, I know he came to comics before Tom Riley, but he feels sort of in the realm of Tom Riley. I don't think he's going to take over drawing any G.I. Joe for Skybound, but it would be a sort of a familiar stylistic fit if he did.
And then we've just got one retailer exclusive for this issue, which is Big Clutch variant. That's a bit of a coincidental name from Ramon Villalobos, which is that quite a cool sort of almost Jeff Darrow-esque scene of our two heroes in the vamp sort of crashing through midair with Stalker and Rock and Roll on the top of the car, and it's a kind of a slightly strange looking frozen in time moment with a bunch of garbage grappling hook grenades magazines sort of falling out of the car at the same time as sort of Stalker is lunging at them with a machete and Rock and Roll is doing his devil horn fingers.
Tom Riley's cover for issue 3 is Duke in the background with his back turned. He's looking back at us as he is ejecting a clip from his pistol. There's a triangle of black above him and behind the logo. And then much closer in the foreground, walking toward us, is the Baroness. She also has a pistol. She's looking straight at us. On the ground behind her around Duke are several masked paramilitary soldier, mercenary, perhaps security guard types. This cover, one of the things that I like that covers can do is be different than the previous issue, so that if they're sitting next to each other on a shelf at a store, you know, it's not like Batman at night with lightning behind him and also Batman at night on a rooftop. And those might be great images, but they sound pretty similar. These two Duke covers, Aqua logo, Red logo, Duke taking up 2/3 of the cover, not full body, but then Duke taking up 1/3 of the cover, full body. You know, they're pretty different. I appreciate that. Cover B for Duke number 3 is
Declan Shalvey.
A really striking image by Declan Shalvey, who's best known for Moon Knight at Marvel, some of the Wolverine Death and Resurrection issues, and his creator-owned book at Image, Old Dog. This cover, Duke is standing atop some armor, the top of a base, and he's looking through a scope, not on top of a weapon, just a single, you know.
I wondered whether it was meant to be the top of a Transformer's head, one of the...
Oh, interesting. Right. It does sort of, there's a triangle that sort of looks like the sort of center forehead plate of an Autobot or a Decepticon. Interesting. Okay. So all the vehicles in the distance, helicopters, planes, a tank, a four-wheeled vehicle, are driving to the right. And Duke is looking to the left. And he's got his one leg is up with his knee bent and he's leaning forward a bit. And he's looking through this, not binoculars, but monoculars, with his weapon at his side. And so I sort of feel like here that this is a retreat or a regrouping, right? And in the distance, there's smoke. And Duke is looking out at what his forces are leaving behind. And this, what's really striking about this cover is that it's monochromatic. It is all in yellows and tans. His hair, his complexion, his costume, the sky, the vehicles, the smoke, the metal that he's standing on, whether it's a base or a weirdly flipped over tank, or maybe some Transformer bit.
And all the logos.
Yes. And the Duke logo and the Skybound icon, etc. Those are also, you know, yellowish tan. Tyler Boss's 1 in 10 ratio variant again connects with the previous two. So the first one was Duke running down a building and smashing out a window. The second one was the previously mentioned Demolition Derby. This time he's in a cross section of the pit, and we know that because of the water tower on top. And he's sort of 80s video game style, sort of side view, side scroller, working his way through various levels, fighting Major Blood. This is a fun cover. I don't think it works on its own. I think, you know, I made this comment in the last year or two about some of the IDW issues where there were several covers that connected, and some of them felt very much like one-fifth of a larger image and didn't really work as striking covers on their own.
Yeah, it feels a bit cropped on the right, doesn't it?
Yeah, I also think that I have seen this visual device a couple times in some comics that I've read this year where an artist draws a character moving through space in a cross-section and you see them several times. Most notably, Juan Jose Rip has done it once or twice in some issues of Wolverine written by Benjamin Percy. And he's done a really spectacular job this past year. And this one feels sort of less considered. And I find the coloring a little bric-a-brac in terms of it not selling the book as an image on its own. That's okay. Because how often are you going to be looking at a new comics rack at a store and it's the 1 in 10, you know, priced up variant. That's the thing that's got to, like, no, that's what covers A and B are for. I do think that, you know, a 5-part visual connecting story is a lot of fun though. And then the 1 in 25 cover is drawn by Priscilla Petraites and colored by Frank Martin. This is another sort of 1982 style package art thing. In this case, it's the Baroness with an explosion behind her. She's jumping at you, which is quite different than the previous 1 in 25 variants we've seen where the characters are standing or perhaps just standing. And then the 1 in 50 cover is...
It's a spoiler variant by Carl Kerschel.
Yeah, and this is Major Blood smiling with a yellowish background behind him with some sort of explosion smoke happening in the distance. We're looking a little bit up at him. We're seeing him from just above his knees up. He's got two different kinds of pistols. One looks like a big mean pistol and one looks like a grappling hook pistol. And
I think it's meant to sort of be inspired by his sort of rocket pistol.
Okay. Yes.
His classified figure comes with like this big sort of handgun, magnum style, oversized pistol. And then it's got a kind of a rocket firing pistol in homage to his version one figure.
Carl Kerschel draws really, really gorgeous comics. He's done creator-owned an Image, a fantasy book called Isola, and I keep thinking of that Flash story he did in DC's Wednesday Comics 15 years ago. This cover, when I saw it in thumbnail form, I actually thought it was Terry and Rachel Dodson in terms of the style, the composition, and the color, which makes me just realize that Kershaw and the Dodsons are sort of more similar than dissimilar. This is a very pretty cover. And it turns out it's a spoiler variant because Major Blood is in the issue.
And looking at the cover, because this was the first time that I sort of was made aware that Major Blood would be in this issue from the solicits with this cover, I was sort of looking at it, and it took me a few seconds of looking at it.
Something's different.
It's about this two-eyed fella here. What could it be? It's.
He does not have his eye patch.
And so for Duke issue 3, no retailer variants. So you've just got your standard, your B, your C, your D, and your E.
You know, for you collectors who gobble up this stuff, I'm sorry.
There's only five covers.
For you collectors who gobble up this stuff, I'm also very happy for you that there's one less thing to get. What do we know about the? Has there been a second print announced of Duke 2?
Yeah, so Duke 1 has just had a third printing announced, which is by George Fornes, which is cool because again, exciting modern artist whose stuff I love.
Folks, he drew the Rorschach miniseries at DC.
Yes, with Tom King writing, and it's kind of a shoulder down shot of Duke holding an assault rifle against a red background. It's quite a striking sort of almost, you know, propaganda style image. It's quite a different looking cover. And then Jason Howard continues his theme of a character spotlight against a white background, this time for Duke issue 2, second printing, with the Baroness. And most of these Cobra Commander and Duke second printings have either had a G.I. Joe star logo on them or a Cobra logo on them as a background. And for Baroness, no logo, just the smoke from a gun. So sort of keeping it ambiguous as to whether she will be a Joe, a Cobra, or neither. Because after all, on that team photo of the Joes and the Cobras, not team photo, team picture drawn by the artist Tom Riley, which was then subsequently a variant cover, she was on Team Duke. So we shall see. But yeah, curious that that she doesn't have that Cobra logo.
Plot breakdown.
Duke, an American hero wanted for murder and on the run, calls in at the auto yard where his old pal Lance Steinberg, aka Clutch, is working. Duke is hurt from his escape from the police and is patched up while Clutch takes a look at the gizmo that Dr. Burkhart has given him. It appears to be a tracker, pointing somewhere in the Mountain States area of the USA. Rock and Roll arrives on the scene, blowing up Clutch's car with fire from his M60. Clutch and Duke take off in a familiar vamp-shaped car, chased by drones and herded to a trap. A stalker snipes out their tires, resulting in the vehicle crashing and Clutch and Duke being taken in. They are taken to a cell in the pit, an underground decommissioned base. In the adjoining cell is Anastasia Sisanova, aka the Baroness. Meanwhile, at Mars HQ, Destro instructs the two-eyed Major Blood to storm the pit and kill Duke. Blood and his bloodhound troopers attack the pit, rappelling from familiar-looking transport choppers. Rock and Roll opens up the cells to move Duke and Clutch, but is taken out by an explosion. Following pleading from the Baroness and an offer of help, Duke also releases her. Major Blood shoots Duke in the leg, and as he levels his weapon in Duke's face, Blood is shot in the head from behind, with the bullet exiting via his left eye. The issue ends on an ambiguous note as the Baroness towers over Duke and says, There's a huge bounty in your head. Is she holding the gun at Duke or handing it to him?
You know, Mark, this was the second Skybound comic book I read this week where someone is shot in the head. The bullet goes through and they lose an eye.
All right. And, have you been reading Walking Dead?
Yes. And for anyone who is well behind on The Walking Dead and discovering it for the first time, kind of like me with the color deluxe presentation, we won't say who, but it's funny the synchronicity that happens when you watch a lot of TV or read a lot of magazines or, you know, read a lot of comics.
Mm.
To be fair to the story in Mark's description just now, because Blood taking that bullet is shown in silhouette, we don't technically know that the bullet goes through his eye. It could have gone through the center of his head and out his forehead. But based on all the context clues, yes, we assume it's his eye.
Yeah, it's the there's a bit of I guess what you'd call probably rim lighting around his nose, which sort of separates kind of his eye sockets,
oh yeah,
and nose from the splat, which makes it indicate that it's on the left hand side of his nose, just level with his eye rather
right,
than
sure.
Center.
I stand corrected. Yes, I'm going to spend much of this episode lauding the work of Tom Riley, so I'll just start here. There's a lot of subtlety in this silhouette on the final page of issue 3 of Duke, where just the head and shoulders of a person getting shot, a lesser artist would not be as sensitive to sort of what details are being specifically shown, though still mostly in silhouette, with a little bit of light on the ear and the nose, a tiny bit of light on the sort of separating the nose from the blood behind it. Right you are. It is definitely taking out his left eye.
There was let's sort of start our conversation at the end. So Major Blood is shot in the head in this sort of grisly this grisly panel, and it prompted one particular comic news website to say major character introduced in Duke issue 3 and killed in the same issue. And I thought to myself, author of this particular piece, have you never read a comic before? Because
or author of this particular piece, don't you know G.I. Joe characters?
Well, it could be either.
Like, where this is definitely Major Blood losing his eye so he can get an eye patch. Mm. As we meet him originally in 1983 as an action figure and on television, he's got an eye patch, and you know, I sort of wonder what happened.
Yeah, I mean, why would you introduce him with two eyes and have him shot in the eye you're not going to introduce the eye patch? And a particular subtlety here, I guess, is that in the classified design, his eye patch is not just like a flap of black fabric. It is a more sort of cybernetic design, which makes me think that maybe there's going to be cybernetics involved in his eye and maybe brain repair. Could even be Transformers related technology that is used to rebuild him.
Interestingly, the character in this month's issue of The Walking Dead Deluxe who gets shot in the head and loses an eye also gets rebuilt.
Cybertronic.
Yeah, with alien robot technology and becomes a Transformers crossover. to what you just said, since we're starting at the end, on the third to last page of Duke issue number 3, Major Blood already has his metal hand and uses it to punch Duke. Duke ducks, Blood hits the wall and shatters the wall, and then Duke punches and Blood blocks the punch with aforementioned metal arm, and it really hurts Duke and makes a sound effect. And so I was wondering, is there already a connection? Is some of Major Blood already Cybertronian?
Mm.
And I don't know if there's any track laid here so far between, you know, Cobra Commander issue 1 and 2, Duke issue 1 and 2 and 3, such that in the timeline, you know, these pre-Cobra characters would have Transformers tech. But I feel like every page that we read of this new Energon universe, we ask ourselves a couple questions. Is a character that we know and love from the 80s about to get reintroduced?
Or killed.
Right. And taken out immediately. Dr. Burkhardt, right? And, you know, to be fair to that article writer online who thought Major Blood was killed off here, that did happen to an established Joe character in the previous issue. And if you are a Joshua Williamson, you might say to Kirkman and Mankiewicz and the folks at Hasbro, hey, there's so many characters. Can I show that the stakes are pretty high? Can I take out an important character early? And this is just one more universe. This is one more iteration. And in 5 or 10 years, this will probably wrap up and then there'll be maybe a new one, not to jump ahead too far. But you might say to Joshua Williamson, yeah, you can take out Major Blood in the same issue as introduced. Okay, so questions that I ask myself every page turn of these two series. One, is a character I know about to get reintroduced? Two, if so, how are they different? Is Williamson introducing a surprise or some irony? Like, wait, the Baroness is locked up with the good guys? Or, wait, the Baroness is kind of a good guy? Because, you know, she's placed with the Duke characters, particularly on the cover to issue 4.
Mm-hmm.
And then the third question is, how is Williamson going to mix or remix established canon to make something new and add meaning for longtime fans? Like, oh, is this scene going to have a dash of Cobra Law? Or is this scene going to be like an Easter egg reference to something from a particular issue or file card or episode? And then lastly, the question every page turn is, are these G.I. Joe characters about to have some interaction with Cybertronian technology?
Mm.
And the answer to all of these questions sort of keeps flipping back and forth, depending on the page turn and the question. Yes, no, yes, yes, no, 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 yes. So there's a lot of fun guessing and I don't say anxiety in a negative way, just sort of not knowing and surprise.
Yeah, and talking to one of the points that you raised about sort of keeping us guessing about, like, you know, familiar characters and how they will or won't be similar to the ones that we know from existing canon. We've got Mercer here, who appears briefly in issue 3, as Destro seems to be packing up his base. So they're sort of unpacking that Mars Industries location that Duke had previously nosed about, I guess implying that maybe, because he's been onto them, that location is a bit blown and compromised and they need to move out, or, you know, could be some other reason. It looks like there's a hiss tank getting loaded into the back of a truck. And we see Mercer on one panel, which he's great to see. He says, "Move it out, losers. We're headed to a new location," with some anonymous kind of workers in masks, sort of, you know, moving various boxes. But we had a conversation, me and Chris McLeod, about Mercer specifically, because I guess the thought process about him is like, well, we know Mercer's story from the movie and the file card and stuff. He was a Cobra and then he turned and he became a Joe. So seeing him here ostensibly working for Destro, thoughts swirl around about what that means. It's like, so is this the beginning of a journey where Mercer is starting out on the side of the baddies and at some point is going to, you know, get swayed over to become a Joe? You know, will that actually happen? How long will it happen? And there was a really good idea which was suggested as a possibility, which is, what if he's already a Joe? What if he's working for someone like Hawk and Duke doesn't know about him and he's deep undercover in Cobra? So it's less of a case of him being a Cobra who then sort of turns tail and joins the Joes, and it's more about he's a Joe who's deep undercover in Cobra, or, you know, working for Destro, and then eventually will return once the gig is up.
Here's another thought which I had because of this idea of Williamson turning things upside down. In the letters page, someone says, "It's great to see Mercer in issue 1. And the two answers are, "We're excited to tell his story. Whether it goes the way of the original, you'll have to keep reading." As you can see with the book, Predict the Unpredictable, this will not follow some sort of set path based on what has happened before. Mm. And I thought, oh, you know, it'd be a really fun decision if Mercer's just a Cobra and stays a Cobra the entire time for yeah. all 3 or 5 or 15 years of this continuity, because we'd keep waiting and, you know, it's established in several other canons that he's a bad guy and he becomes a good guy. And there would be such a delicious anxiety for us fans if, you know, well, maybe next month is the month that he starts to turn. And, you know, maybe Williamson thinks like, no, he's just a Cobra. I can't help but think that the Baroness being not quite a good guy, but so far helping the good guys, you know, we've seen in many G.I. Joe stories over the years in different media, a Joe and a Cobra or a Joe and some other villain team up temporarily. And certainly the Baroness has been with Cobra and on the outs with Cobra over the years. Because it was such a big and flashy example of the Baroness being on the side of Duke and the Baroness being a hero character who turns bad, I keep being reminded in this Joshua Williamson continuity of the first live action movie, G.I. Joe, The Rise of Cobra, where in flashback, Duke and the Baroness are they an item? They date or they're friends?
Yeah. And then, yeah, they're an item. Yeah.
And I didn't like that then. But also, it's been a long time. And, you know, certainly a lot of interesting other things are happening here. And there's already a lot of subtlety with what the Baroness is doing, even from the second to last page of Duke number 3 to the third, to the last page. So I don't think Joshua Williamson is doing what that movie did. That makes me grumpy. That's not what's happening. But I'm thinking, oh, you know what this most reminds me of? Because, you know, Duke and the Baroness didn't, they were never like a matchup, you know, particularly in G.I. Joe before that movie. And so maybe any time they're matched up, or if there's a two-pack of action figures in the future, I'll just think back to that time that it sort of first happened in a big way.
Yeah, and I guess it's a different dynamic. I mean, the movie was, you know, strange. She was his girlfriend. Her brother became Cobra Commander. And, you know, it was all a little bit, here she is, at least she's being introduced as a bad guy or bad girl. She is, you know, described as a full on terrorist. And it looks like, you know, an assassin marksman. We've got lots of Polaroid photos here of bodies, chalk outlines of people that implied that she's assassinated. So
you're talking about the 2-page spread montage of her past, right, in issue 3?
Yeah. So definitely a baddie, but, you know, can she be redeemed? Can she, you know, or put that on hold long enough to do the right thing? Or maybe she'll be swayed by Duke's charms to
before
be on the side of angels.
We should probably jump back to the beginning of these two issues and talk about story and art, since we've talked about publishing and the end of them, the stories. Yeah. But I did want to point out that in a broad sense, Duke number 1 was thrilling. Cobra Commander 1 was thrilling. There's a lot of leeway for Joshua Williamson to do his own thing, to do weird things, maybe even to do things that I don't like. So far, he's not. But because Skybound is publishing two different G.I. Joe universes right now. That said, you know, based on sales at my store and also the anecdotal evidence provided by the letters in issue 3, these comics so far are connecting with audiences, and everything about Cobra Commander 1 and 2 and Duke 1 and 2 and 3 to me has said, if you are a casual or lapsed G.I. Joe fan, a lot of this will all feel familiar enough that you're like, yeah. And also it's very exciting and pretty. And so you'll say, yeah. And if you don't know G.I. Joe at all, these are fun and interesting comics. Mm. And many of you will say, yeah. So both as a Joe fan and also as someone, I can't look at these and imagine what I would think of them if I didn't care about G.I. Joe. But I do know that, you know, if a solid writer with artists and color artists whose work I really like were doing this kind of work on I don't know, like Buffy the Vampire Slayer or like the Universal Monsters, some other licensed stuff that I don't have any connection to. I might not have an emotional connection to them, but I think I would really enjoy the comics. And so I'm excited for sort of everyone.
Yeah, there were definitely a few examples in that letter page where people were saying that it's the first time that they've ever read a G.I. Joe comic. So they've, you know, it's going to be illustrative of the kind of letters that they've got in, but also, I guess, in terms of curating the letters page of, the story they want to craft.
All right, so let's talk about the beginning of issue two.
Yeah, so Duke rocks up at this auto yard that called Manny's Mean Machines that Clutch is at in a mobile home. He starts off on the roof of it, you know, having a drink.
Do we know who Manny is, Mark?
So from Clutch's file card, it starts, Clutch was a mechanic at Manny's Mean Machines and was heavily involved in racing street machines prior to enlistment. So it's a callback to his file card.
Okay. Which Duke then calls back to, which Clutch then calls back to a couple pages later when he says, me and this guy were kids, I'd build them and he'd crash them.
Mm.
And that was before we went on the straight and narrow.
And we also see that he's graduated from Massachusetts Institute of Technology, Lance.
Hey, that's three subway stops from
me. Lance J. Steinberg. Obviously, that's Clutch's file name. That's him. A big bit of cartooning as Duke walks into the room and surprises him. Why don't you pour one for me while you're at it, Clutch? Ah, sort of sloshing his coffee. You know, his eyes going all askance and his neck jumping out of. jumping all the way to the ceiling, practically.
And then a second really lovely bit of cartooning, both in drawing and in composition and in color at the bottom of that page, when they clench their hands together, when they shake hands in that way that's not a standard handshake.
That's definitely an Easter egg recall back to the Arnold Schwarzenegger and Carl Weathers handshake from Predator. Dutch and Dylan.
Dylan! You son of a bitch. What's the matter? The CIA got you pushing too many pencils? Huh?
Here, Jordy Belair halos each of these two guys in a thick yellow line. And then there's this sort of like solar flare, this like yellow circular burst around their fists, which feels very video gamey and manga influenced. And if you were to describe that to me before I read it, I would put on my grumpiest Western comics reading old school face and say, I don't know about that. But it's delightful. And it very much reinforces that these guys know each other, they trust each other, they love each other. And as a visual change from the rest of the panel, the rest of the page, If I start talking about Jordy Belair's colors, I'm not going to stop for 5 minutes. So let me just back up here and talk about this opening scene. The first six pages of Duke issue number two are a really nicely constructed scene. I mean, in terms of writing, and I don't write comics in any traditional sense. I have written and drawn my own like autobiographical comics, and I have drawn hilarious Transformers fan comics when I was in high school. But, you know, I don't like sit down and write like my own issue of X-Men or my own creator-owned stuff. So I don't like study the writing, the craft of writing comics. But sometimes a scene just jumps out as so well done that I can't help but take note. And I feel like if I wanted to learn how to write comics, and there are many great examples and scenes and scripts and how-to books, so you don't have to start with some G.I. Joe comic. But if you're already reading G.I. Joe comics, the first six pages here are a really nice example of how to tell some story. So in these six pages, we get a bunch of sort of character presentation and reveal where in the first four panels, right on the first page, We see what Clutch is seeing. We see him reacting. The third panel is this really like wonderful and unusual close-up of his hand flicking a toothpick. And, you know, hands are not easy to draw if you don't practice drawing hands, he said to his students. And just the little bits of character where Clutch is wearing, like, there's the second panel, right? He's definitely sunbathing. He's definitely relaxing. You know, he's under an umbrella. He's sitting on some kind of, you know, beach chair, a lawn chair. He's got sunglasses on. And then he stands up and he stretches, right? You know, what did you get yourself now? What did you get yourself into now, Conrad? And then you turn the page and there's this beautiful top of page 2 and top of page 3, half double page spread showing where he is. And it wasn't a mystery. Like, oh, is he at the beach? Like, oh, he's not at the beach. I was wrong. He's at his Midwestern or like mid-Atlantic car lot. But it's like, oh, cool. Here's all this visual information I've just been fed where he's not like, time to go to work fixing cars, right? And then the sign like tells you, and then the diploma tells you. But even this little character bit where he blows a kiss to, it's not clear if it's, I guess it's actually the car behind the mobile home. It's not all of the other cars.
It's his special car. Yeah.
And then, you know, and then he says nothing wrong with day old coffee. It's like, okay, we're getting more and more. It's like, yes, he's telling us that. He's not showing us that. Joshua Williamson is telling us that. He's not showing us that. But, you know, there's dialogue in comics, and you can also have narration too. And so we get to know a lot about this character with sort of a minimum amount of outlay, you know, like, oh, he's messy because there are three crushed cans in front of that diploma, and there are also two can tabs torn off in front of them. And then he's having day-old coffee and he's pouring it into a mug. And so I start to fill in the gaps. I think, oh, that mug probably hasn't been washed. Or I wonder if he's also going to put some bourbon in that coffee. And, you know, maybe Hasbro wouldn't go for that. Although there sure is a lot of blood in Cobra Commander this month, so that should be okay. And then it goes even a step further with this woman who Clutch has definitely slept with the night before, showing up, which adds a really great contrast and an opportunity for humor because he's such a clod. And she walks out. And then Tom Riley's camera angle, quote unquote, it's not a film, it's a comic, so there's no camera. But his camera angle on the bottom of page 5, where as she's walking out, the camera is at like 3 feet, but it's at a Dutch angle, which is often reserved for like something's wrong. The character or the audience is supposed to feel unbalanced because literally the camera is unbalanced on the tripod. In this case, it's just allowing compositionally us to see Duke and Clutch's body language and their faces, and also to give a little bit of a close-up on her short shorts, her bare legs, the body language as she's walking away from them in a huff, her fists that are sort of cocked in that, like, I'm impatiently and angrily walking away. And then Duke says, I see you still have a way with the ladies. And then Clutch seems to quote Batman Forever, which I'm never in favor of.
Chicks dig the cars.
It's the car, right? Chicks love the car.
And then you turn the page and there's this great turn where you've been enjoying these two guys getting back together. If you're in favor of characters having sex before the scene starts, you can sort of, you know, pump your fist for Clutch, who like took someone home the night before. But then Duke doubles over in pain and Riley inks a bunch of like white burst lines behind Duke, which is not a light source. There's no like flashlight or car headlights behind him. That's just a comic book effect to show that something accentuated is happening to this person, right? And it doesn't even continue past the door frame. It's sort of happening behind the door frame, behind these two guys. And Jordy Belair just knocks it in a slightly dull red. And then you sort of realize, like, oh, his shirt is all torn up. And Duke says, maybe from the bullets or the glass from jumping out a window, right? Mm. And then, like, one final sort of bit of telling you who Clutch is and what he does. You know, he doesn't say, let's get you to a hospital, or I have a doctor friend. He says, let's get you into the shop and give you a tune-up. Mm. And he's helping Duke walk past all these cars toward an actual garage. And, you know, when a character in like G.I. Joe or Transformers sort of has a, like a talking trope, you know, like Jazz in Transformers is always like quoting music or talking like a DJ on the radio would. That's fun. Sometimes it's a bit much. And so you can get carried away with this. Like, I'm not expecting everything Clutch says for the next several issues to be like car related, like car references and racing puns. But this one fits, you know, he doesn't say like, oh man, I have to get my scalpel and take out those bullets. He says, let's get you into the shop and give you a tune up.
Mm.
So these first six pages are a really nice presentation of story, backstory, character, contrasts. You know, the woman who walks out, she's only in one page. It's just a very satisfying scene. Mark, what else do you want to talk about with this issue?
Funnily enough, that one character on the League of Comic Geeks website, which is a great website for sort of seeing lots of different variant covers for an issue and stuff, they have sort of like clickable kind of characters of who appears in any given issue. And on here they have Sherry, who they describe. Sherry is a lady friend of Clutch. The two spent a night together. In the morning, Clutch couldn't remember her name. So someone's created a character profile for this one-page character and given her a name. I don't know if there's a name mentioned anywhere else in the book.
No, there is when the vamp crashes.
Uh-huh.
Clutch, his head's against the wheel, and he says, come back to bed, Sherry. And Duke says, now you remember her name.
Right, fantastic.
So I think, I don't think we're going to see this character again. I don't think it's a Joe. I don't think it's a Zorana in disguise. I don't think it's the Baroness in disguise. I don't think it's a Synthoid. I think that's the internet in a wonderful internet way, making an entry or a reference to sort of anything and everyone.
There's, in this sequence, there's a nice little sort of Easter egg, which is in the junkyard. There, on the right-hand side, there's a car with the, what do you call it, trunk, the boot, open. And there's some like red things in the back of the boot there.
You're talking about the two-page spread, pages
yes.
two and three.
Yeah. And that is a reference to Tyler Boss's stolen Kia car. He had a Kia car, which was stolen. And it contained all sorts of, you know, his books and his art in there, and it had been covered when it came back. It had been covered in gasoline from a fuel can, and you can just about see that red fuel can in the back of the car. So obviously, Tom Riley there giving a little nod to his pal Tyler Boss, and as well, it just being a little fun thing being put in there that no one would never ever know about apart.
You know what? Actually, looking at these two pages, I had wondered if there was something particular about that vehicle, because every other vehicle in the junkyard is an older car. Mm-hmm. This one is a newer car.
More defined.
This car doesn't have any obvious damage. It's not missing its wheels. And Jordi Belair is so careful with her color choices. All the other cars are, you know, muted colors, like muted blue, muted yellow, muted brown, muted gray. And then it's not a bright yellow and it's not a bright red, but comparatively, those two cans do stick out.
Mm.
And Clutch is on the left looking to the right, perhaps at the back of that Kia. And I thought, I don't know what this is, but I think it might be something.
There we go. But yeah, I think part of this new generation of hot artists that we're seeing a lot of across the Energon books. So then we're in a very different scene inside the shop after Duke has had a couple of, I guess those are bullets taken out of him, I guess, that's in the tray.
They look like teeth.
They look like teeth, but I don't think they're teeth.
Gotta say. Maybe bullets oxidize or something and turn white. I think they're meant to be teeth. Excuse me. I think they're meant to be bullets.
Or glass, maybe.
Huh.
Yes, something. And then there's a doohickey there that he's sort of investigating. It's the device that Dr. Burkhart had given to Duke, and he plugs it in to try and find out what it is. And he says, it's like a low jack that you'd put into your car, sort of. And I kind of got the idea of what a low jack is, but I did Google it just to be sure, because it's I think it's probably something that's more commonly referred to in the States. And for our international audience, the low jack product is a battery operated stolen vehicle recovery system that helps law enforcement to track and recover your stolen vehicle. A low jack unit is hidden in your vehicle by a certified technician, and your vehicle is registered in the low jack database. So it kind of gives you a good idea of what this device might be doing. It's potentially a stealth tracker to track something, which looks to be not too far away from Las Vegas, if that red bleeping red dot is meant to be accurate.
Yeah. So the five questions that every page turn asks us, you know, am I about to see a character who I know? It's also, am I about to see a gadget or a location that I know? So, you know, if someone refers to like the northwestern United States, I'm going to think, oh, the Autobot spaceship. Or if someone refers to, you know, Utah, we're going to think the Pit. Or if someone refers to New York, we might think, oh, Staten Island. And I don't know yet what to make of this one. And
then the next panel is Destro in his den, and there's a bleep on his armrest. And I guess the implication is that by the Duke and Clutch activating this device, it has alerted Destro to its usage, which I guess triggers then the events of the next issue. I think it's kind of cute that we're seeing Destro sort of hidden by shadows. Who is this mystery man? When I think anyone reading this book, even if you're not a G.I. Joe expert, will probably look at that kind of partial silhouette and think to yourself, I think we might guess that this is Destro. And
yeah.
And leaning very closely into specifically the classified version of Destro as well, you can kind of see the kind of tubing on his shoulders and stuff, some of the little details that are more particular to the classified design.
All three issues of Duke so far obstruct or obscure a full reveal of Destro. We know it's him from context, Mars, the red collar, a shiny head, but we're seeing his hand, or he's in shadow. And I agree, we all know it's Destro. I think even a lot of people who've never read G.I. Joe comics would know who Destro is and would look at this panel and think, oh, that must be Destro. So it's less Williamson and Riley trying to surprise us and more just creating some small sort of fan tension, because when he finally does show up in a future issue, we'll be giddy. You know, we'll get to see him in probably a, you know, page turn, full page splash, where he'll say something cool, or he'll be standing next to someone or something really interesting. And I think this is totally okay and not a weird misfire, because it's not about like, who is that? once again, I'm just, every single page of this, I'm so struck by Jordi Belair's light touch, seemingly with color, but very smart and careful. This is not simple color, like a rush job, like she's out of time and she can only put, you know, 3 or 8 or 9 colors on any one panel or page. You know, this is not she's out of time and she's using flats and some hard edges. She's changing her color script for every scene. So when Duke and Clutch are outside or inside, when they head back inside, you know, the color shifts from blue daylight to yellow cast to a different yellow cast to a green cast. In issue 3, you know, when we're actually in issue 2 and issue 3, when we're in the pit, it's all blue. When Major Blood shows up in issue 3, it's all red. You know, it's outside even before he shows up, when Stalker's topside and a vehicle approaches, and then it turns out that Blood is showing up, it's all red. Some of this is about what color approach best suits Tom Riley's art. Tom Riley does not want a full rendering of color the way that, you know, you're getting on a lot of X-Men comics these days, the way that, you know, Brian Hitch is getting colored on, you know, that Ultimate Universe miniseries, or presumably his upcoming creator-owned stuff. with Jeff Johns. Riley's art is, it's not flat, but it is a style that is very much about planes of space and geometric shapes, both in how he draws people, how he draws backgrounds and tech, how he is inking, and how he is simplifying and reducing. And, you know, this is like jumping ahead, but if you turn to page, just as a random example, if you turn to page 3 of issue 3, we see Hawk on a computer monitor, and there's a random guard below him who's sort of lit from below, who's wearing a hat. And Riley is blocking in some shadows and flattening their faces. And, you know, the opposing page, the big reveal of Major Blood sitting, big splash page, Major Blood sitting in a sort of geometric throne, holding a gun with his leg crossed, with some booze. You know, there's nothing particularly about that page that says this can't be colored like the way that Alex Sinclair colors Jim Lee. But I sure don't want that based on how Tom Riley subtly simplifies things. So back to issue 2, you know, like I look at the very first page of this comic, issue 2 of Duke, and there's just one color for Clutch's skin tone. There's just one color for the sky. And I don't want that to do anything else. I don't feel shortchanged. I feel like it's really satisfying and beautiful. And occasionally where Belair can add some flair, like highlights from the sunlight when Duke surprises Clutch a couple pages in, Clutch is splashing the coffee the way that you referred to. And there's a little bit of a highlight on Duke's finger and hair. There's a little bit of a highlight on the right side of Clutch. It's very much about what's appropriate.
Mm, some of that Belair flair.
Oh, man.
So in back into the story, they're coming out of the shop. There's another little Easter egg reference here. You know, not a chance. Not even your baby bro. I can't involve him. This is too dangerous. So baby bro, mine's instantly going to Falcon. And there was a reference to his brother being the screw up back in issue 1 when Hawk was talking to him. And then we get this one, you know, splash page reveal of Rock and Roll firing his M60 and blowing up Clutch's pride and joy. Kaboom.
Can I jump in with a quick thing?
Go on.
The page before the splash reveal of Rock and Roll, there's this really nice bit of writing and storytelling where the panels alternate between Clutch and Duke and then Rock and Roll. So Clutch and Duke are talking, and then an arm puts down a boombox. Clutch and Duke are talking, and they're on the left aiming right, and then a hand is holding ear protection. They're still talking, and then there's this close up. So you have these like these moment panels. And then Duke says, "Do you hear that?" And this is a very small thing. It's not brilliant or rocket science. It's just really good comics making 101. But generally in this scene, Clutch and Duke are on the left facing right. And then you turn the page and Rock and Roll is on the right facing left. And it wouldn't be confusing or weird if he, on this full page splash, were flopped and aiming the other way. But, you know, he's far enough away that it sort of doesn't matter where he is. But in terms of establishing where characters are and then reestablishing, in terms of keeping track and making sure your reader doesn't get confused, it's a small thing, and then it continues on to the next page. You know, the close up of him doing the devil horns with his hand, boom, 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 and he's smiling. He's on the right, looking left. Three panels later, when you just see his gun pointing at the garage, he's on the right, facing left. And so, keeping that consistent is a really nice, helpful bit. And then there's this fun mix of old and new, where we see the vamp, although it's a little wide, so it makes me think a little bit of the hammer. But
it's leaning again into the classified redesign.
Ah, okay. So we see the vamp, which is, you know, 1982 G.I. Joe. But we also see drones, which is, you know, 2015, 2024.
With mounted machine guns on them.
Yeah. Which is, you know, maybe not realistic, but it's G.I. Joe.
Yeah, it's probably only a couple of minutes in the future, isn't it? It's
Actually, I don't know a lot about military drones, and some of them are sort of like mini planes and have missiles or rockets on them. So maybe I take that back.
And so they're being herded into a trap. A stalker there on a sniper rifle. I don't know. It looks like, is it a Barrett or something? I'm not going to claim to be a gun expert here, but a big old sniper, looks high caliber, and blasts out their tires. Bang, bang, boom, boom, and then a crash into the tree, and that takes out his clutch. Now he remembers Sherry's name, and there's Stalker come to take in Duke.
Before you refer to the Easter egg, right? Mm. We've also described how we like Russ Wooten's lettering in this book.
Let's talk about SFX, baby. Let's talk about pew and scree. Let's talk about shooting gun things and the sound effects. We'll see. Let's talk about SFX. Let's talk about SFX.
Lettering can be hard to sort of point out why it's good or why it needs improvement. You know, the best lettering is not quite invisible, but sort of accentuates the art and doesn't get in the way. Which sounds like such a backhanded compliment. But this page where Stalker fires the rifle, right? Look at what the sound effects are doing. Stalker's bang, bang, that's a font, and they're italicized. So it's sort of sharp and definitive, right? That's a very specific sound with a beginning and an end. But then the sound of the tires being shot out, trish, boom, trish, boom, those look hand-lettered, and then the crash, right, is irregular and hand-lettered. It's not a font. Might be based on a font, but those sounds are much more irregular and organic, right? They're not mechanical. Mm. And so you can have differences that aren't as simple as, like, you know, it's like, you know how like the Wall Street Journal and like the Washington Post are in that like old font, the actual masthead logos of those newspapers. And you might say to someone, I want something to look like, you know, the 1880s or like England 200 years ago. Like, no, I want like a futuristic, like, computer font, right? But you can actually be much more subtle than that. And this page makes that kind of decision. And all right, so what does Stalker do, Mark?
So Stalker, Duke comes at him, throws a punch, which Stalker deftly dodges, and says, let me show you a move an old friend taught me. Crack! And we get this kinetic blurred leg through the air, connecting with Duke's head, knocking him to the ground. An old friend taught him that move.
So he's either talking... So we are led to think...
Mm.
Williamson is not implying, we're inferring. So if we're wrong, it's on us. But it's probably Snake Eyes or Storm Shadow.
It's a knowing inferral, isn't it?
Yeah. But, you know, it could be Jinx. It could be some made-up character, you know. But that tension is really fun, because you can say, hey, I know who that is. And then you can say, or do I?
Mm. So it could be Snake Eyes, which is what would be the first thought, because, you know, they're on the same team. But it could also be Storm Shadow, because the three of them, in at least in Aira canon, they serve together. In Nam, in the long-range recon patrol together. So, you know, we've got no insight into this Stalker's background here, but, you know, we imagine that maybe there's some shared history that is being referred to here.
One of the things that I really like so far about the G.I. Joe third of the Energon universe is how little Snake Eyes there has been. There has been zero Snake Eyes. I love that character. Once again, how can this either contrast itself from the Larry Hama world, where there are currently 2.5 Snake Eyeses? and also, how can this, you know, if you were to start X-Men over right now, completely over, you might not have Wolverine in the first issue. You might save him because he's cool and everyone loves him. And despite the alien robots and the 40,000-year-old snake man in the Himalayas, this G.I. Joe is really grounded. And once you start mixing in, you know, ninja and destiny and sort of the best fighter who ever existed, who can sort of do anything. You stretch that a little bit, and Snake Eyes would fit in this story and in this universe, and I'm sure he will soon. But I note that in the letters page of issue 3, someone says, I'm looking forward to these groups. I'll just say I'm hopeful to see those elements. I'm curious to know how soon we'll see characters like Flint, Lady J, Snake Eyes, Scarlet, and Beachhead appear in the Energon universe. And the two answers are, some soon, some not so soon at all. And who's Snake Eyes? I don't know that one. Now, that's Joshua Williamson being cheeky, but it's really cool that G.I. Joe doesn't need Snake Eyes to be exciting and hit. And so we can build up this anticipation for when he does show up. And, you know, maybe he's going to show up sort of half fully formed, or maybe he's going to show up sort of before the injury, before the trauma.
Yeah, they have said on record in interviews multiple times that they want to put off including Snake Eyes for as long as possible. And I guess that makes sense for two reasons. Again, you know, like all of the reasons you said about not including Snake Eyes immediately. But also, if they are going out and saying that publicly, and the readers are thinking that he's not going to come anytime soon, when he does, it's even more of a surprise. Like, no, we're not going to see Snake Eyes. Oh, issue 4, there's Snake Eyes.
Right.
I did sort of see two things that were sort of on the boundaries of my error-detected detector machine. Shall I tell you what they are, Tim?
Yeah.
Of this sequence. There was the first one was as Clutch is driving away and they're being, you know, shot at, Clutch says, I'm not the best driver, but this guy's aim sucks. This is Clutch, the vamp driver. The guy who's the driver, the guy who's, you know, into the cars and into repairing them. Is he just modest?
I think this is Williamson sliding the characters, you know, a little bit out of their sort of familiar zone.
And then the other one, I was just a bit of storytelling logic, which kind of slightly irked me, which is where they say, my partner and I needed to get you away from any civilians where no one would see us take you in. And it just seemed to me like Manny's Mean Machines auto yard looked pretty deserted apart from Duke and Clutch. And surely going out onto an open road, being chased by machine gun toting drones and then letting loose with heavy caliber sniper rifles and blowing up cars and making them smash into trees is a little bit more public and ostentatious than taking them out at the auto yard.
I started to think the same thing too. Now that you say it, there was a civilian at Manny's auto yard.
Yeah, she stormed off though. That was a while ago.
True, but you know, they... Yeah, true. While we're doing error detected, this is still issue 2. Back on page 2, when Clutch blows the kiss to all of the vehicles, in the art, there's a heart. In the lettering, there's a sound effect. M-E-W exclamation mark mu, which I think is this sound. Mwah! And it's on Clutch's
sound?
Nose.
Mew, mew,
It is not a cat sound. Okay. It is a blowing a kiss sound. And the actual lettering is on Clutch's nose. And I feel like that kind of wanted to be, you know, 200 pixels to the left and up. So if that gets fixed in a collection, I'll be proven right, error detected.
Here's a little thing on the next page of the story. Mm. As Duke is being transported in a chopper, he's got a blue hood on his head, Tim. I thought those weren't allowed anymore.
I think you might be reading a little too specifically. I think that's really a black hood. And because we are inside a vehicle in the limited color world of Jordi Belair, it's blue.
It's like it's not, Superman's hair.
Yeah, I mean, because in the panel under it, I wouldn't describe rock and roll's complexion as like pickle green. That's Caucasian in a, like, inside a helicopter out of direct sunlight. Something that I really appreciate that Tom Riley does is he gives rock and roll a definitively different body type and facial type. He's bigger than the other characters. He's taller. His head is wider. And that's just fun because, you know, I'm okay with every Joe being the exact same body type and like all sort of prototypically 6 foot one. But in real life, they're not. So.
And it would be very easy for, with the different artistic treatments of the character for rock and roll and Duke to get a little bit confusing, you know, blonde guys, long hair, sort of a little bit of a beard going on. I really wasn't expecting to see the Pit in this issue.
Yeah, this is another really fun sort of surprise and turn, the same way that in Cobra Commander 1, a Cobra Law citizen or scientist who looks like Cobra Commander in G.I. Joe the movie says retreat and then is killed. And then you realize Cobra Commander is a different person in the scene and just did that killing. So your expectation is turned on its head. A little bit of that happens here where we turn the page and we see something that we know from G.I. Joe comics is the Pit or some version of the Pit. Because in Marvel G.I. Joe number one and in IDW G.I. Joe, I forget. Something. Oh, also in yearbook one, right? And then in like IDW 200 or 205 or something, we get another diagram of the Pit.
Yeah. And we get that great Pit cross section in issue 3 of ARR as well.
Okay.
As they're kind of traveling down the lift.
Yes. Oh, and then the Billy Penn cover, cover B for what's his issue? 286, 7. I'm sorry, Billy. So here we see the Pit, and it is both a splash page, but also a diagram of a space to reinforce just how sort of deep underground, off the grid, these two people are being sort of locked up and the keys being thrown away. Because not only are they under a base, they're under a decommissioned base. And then there's this little, I don't know if this is technically an Easter egg, because G.I. Joe makes references to other versions of G.I. Joe, but Duke says, I thought the Pit was decommissioned in the 80s, right? So we're all supposed to think, the 80s, like that decade that G.I. Joe started in when we first met the Pit, right? And it's like, no, it's not actually an Easter egg. It sort of rhymes with an Easter egg.
Yeah.
And then a couple cool things happen. Duke knows who these two guys are. He knows their names and their code names. Mm. And this is both smart and maybe unfair on the part of Williamson, who can keep impressing us with how good at sort of everything Duke is. You know, it's not just that he knows languages from his file card. It's not just that he's a capable and superlative, you know, soldier. He can punch, he can jump, he can fire. And he's been doing all this great fighting and escaping in these issues. It's that he's got intelligence, like military intelligence in his head. And it happens again in issue 3 when he knows who the prisoner next to him is, who's the reveal for the end of issue 2. It may be a little unfair on Williamson's part because Williamson can keep sort of inventing more and more for Duke to know and like may not have to explain it the way that like Larry Hama can have Storm Shadow locked up in a jail cell in, what is it, issue 24, I forget, of the Marvel run, and he can escape, and someone can say, there's no way to escape. And Hama, it's a magic trick. Hama doesn't need to explain it because he doesn't have to explain it to us. He can just write the next sentence that this like impossible ninja got out of this impossible scenario. So Duke, there's a slight risk here that there's going to be this like intelligence and expertise creep, and that sort of as more issues happen and the stakes go up, Duke will become a little less of a believable superlative expert and sort of a Superman who can sort of do anything and knows like anything that the scene like wants him to know so we can be impressed by him. I don't think that's actually going to happen, but as Duke keeps saying and doing these amazing things, I think on the one hand, man, Diana Davis must be so psyched. And also, okay, so G.I. Joe hasn't really ever had a main character. Maybe it's Snake Eyes. And briefly in the 80s, you thought it was Duke. Mm. And this comic is called Duke, to be fair. It's not called G.I. Joe. But I'm sort of aware of, like, well, Duke's been in a jet and he's got a jetpack and he can drive the vamp and he knows who these two guys are. He's starting to have the expertise of not just his one action figure character, but several others. Mm. And so I do anticipate when other characters get to do really amazing things that they can do. And I interrupted you. What were you going to say about the prison scene? Or the?
They do it again in issue 3 as well. Stalker and Rock and Roll are talking to Hawk on a video call. And right. Stalker says, Duke is one of the most decorated soldiers to ever hit the field. And it doesn't feel right in my gut locking him up in the pit like this. So, you know, they're sort of complimenting Duke. But at the same time, they're saying, we're good guys. We're G.I. Joes. You don't have to worry about us
Wait,
being
do
baddies.
Do the next line.
And then Rock and Roll says, Duke was really banged up when we got to him and his buddy. If he was in top shape, I don't think we would have been able to bring him in at all.
So on the one hand, that's a really cool line. And like, high five, Diana. Your favorite character is getting his day in the sun and is getting to do a lot more than he has done in episodes or other comics in a long time. You know, it's like it hasn't been since...
Too bad he'll die in issue 5.
No, it's like, you know, if you watch the first episode of the animated series, the first episode, he's the leader and they're all great, but he does get to do sort of more of the best stuff. this line where Duke could have taken out Rock and Roll and Stalker if he had been in tip top shape, that's fun. Sure, the comic's called Duke. It's not called Duke and Rock and Roll and Stalker, but it's a little bit much. And you know what it also reminds me of, speaking of little bits of the Duke miniseries that remind me of the live action Rise of Cobra movie, this light attempt, which was totally reasonable in that first live action movie, to make it not a team movie, but like a main character movie where Channing Tatum's Duke is the guy you're following. You know, he's got the best friend. He's joining the team. They're joining the team. He's got the girlfriend in his past. You know, he's going to take down the bad guys. And yes, also it's a team. And I think there's always going to be this tension in G.I. Joe where any one writer or film director, producer, or, you know, depending on the era, someone from Hasbro might say, hey, put this character or these two or three characters in the spotlight. And I don't mean like a solo issue or, you know, like a toy recolor. Like, oh, they keep redoing Snake Eyes. They keep redoing Snake Eyes. I mean, in a narrative character way. And, you know, there's always going to be a tension in X-Men comics. How much Wolverine? There's always going to be a tension in Justice League comics. How much Batman? Because he's the most popular. He's a lot of people's favorite. And he can't do more things than some of those like gods and aliens. But he also can.
Mm.
So I'll hand it back to you in 1 second. So we get this jail scene underground at the pit. And once again, there's this really nice bit of left to right and right to left visual presentation from Tom Riley, where Duke is talking from right, looking left. And then in the final panel of this second to last page, we see a woman's hand. And then when you turn the page, the reveal of who it is, she's on the right looking left. And just another subtle, nice example of clear establishing sort of where characters are. So, Mark, what do you think of this final scene?
It's good. It's a nice reveal. It's intriguing and a little bit, you know, a little bit sexy even. Obviously, that whole prison thing is very much a theme of issue 3 as Baroness wants to make a deal with Duke somehow, get them to escape. And he's kind of showing his mettle that he's, you know, he's still on the side of angels. And she sort of is like trying to get a rise out of him a little bit.
A nice decision that Tom Riley makes. His Baroness is really in shape. She's, I don't know if I'd say she's jacked, but she has a lot of muscle tone. And this isn't just because she's wearing like a sports top and has a bare midriff. Tom Riley is drawing her as someone who exercises and lifts weights. That is a specific body type. This isn't just like skinny, sexy Baroness or like Baroness in her skin tight costume. This is like biceps and shoulders. And it's a subtle thing, but I really appreciate it. And then something else that's happening, which is great in this opening prison scene in issue 3, is really nice body language. So Duke is sitting against the wall, leaning forward with his arms on his knees. Clutch is lying on his back in this jail cell, much less tense. Baroness, you know, points when she says, "If you knew who I was, you wouldn't speak to me." Right? You turn the page and she's got short hair in the visual flashback, which is a neat sort of change. So
Shorter than that. She's got still got relatively short hair compared to her normal look in the present, but shorter in the flashback. And that, and she is called Anastasia Sisarovna, which is not necessarily a name that she is often referred to. It's not an invention for this series. Most of the time in ARAR on various file cards, she's been called Anastasia de Cobre. I was trying to do some desk research about where that name first came from, and it looks like it was probably sourced from the Renegades episode Union of the Snake. I was chatting to Pat Stewart about his thoughts on it, and that's his guess as well. And he said that episode was written by Eugene Son, who was also a G.I. Joe fan, and thought that was potentially just a way of slightly reinventing the Baroness and shifting her away from the name De Cobre, which was kind of initially introduced as a kind of joke before it came her more kind of official name.
When you say joke, you mean because it sounds and looks like cobra, so it's sort of cute, but it maybe doesn't make sense.
Yeah, and in the context of when it's first used, I think it's as Major Bludge is checking her into a hospital, and it seems like a kind of a sort of a joke cover name rather than an actual name.
Right. What else is fun about issue 3?
I think the funnest thing is having Major Blood, and he's on that splash page as a reveal. We find out that it was him that killed Burkhart, as we guessed from the mention of an Australian accent. But he just looks great. I love the character generally, and I wish Larry Hammer would use him more in ARAR. But, you know, that look with the slick back hair, the classified redesign, which is sort of just a great kind of modern update, and the way that he's drawn by Riley, and some of the, you know, dialogue from Joshua Williamson, he's just great. And I love this splash of him being introduced where he just looks, you know, that slick back hair, the sort of smarmy smile, a slightly deranged look in his eye, holding that bottle of wine at the same time as holding a giant pistol. It's fantastic stuff.
Yeah, speaking of great body language, and it's just again, color by Jordi Belair, this page is not boring. It's not underdeveloped. There is more than one color here, definitely. But if you squint, Belair is basically only working with one color. And it's gorgeous, and it fits. I want to jump ahead a couple pages. The two-page splash of the bloodhounds rappelling out of these helicopters, which look like the Aspids, the sort of cargo helicopters that we know from Real American Hero.
Yearbook 2.
Did those first show up in Yearbook 2?
I believe that's their first appearance, yeah.
Okay. And these ones here look a little narrower, which I'm going to chalk up to like how an artist draws them for the first time, as opposed to a specific like design change. I want to point out a couple things. Even though you might look at this two-page splash and say, oh, the entire background is red, and also I think that's cool, there is a lot of subtlety in what Belair does with any one color, and she's embedding a lot of subtle texture. So get up close, and you'll see a lot of like paper texture, or what you might like technically called noise, like sort of pixels that are doing different things than the pixels next to them, look around the moon on the top right of this two-page splash. It's not a pure red. It looks more like the red you'd get from like printmaking, from like slapping some ink on a piece of linoleum and pressing it against a piece of paper and lifting it up, where it's not the like perfectly uniform color from Photoshop. Something else that I think is cool about this two-page splash, I think Joshua Williamson has just invented a whole new sort of Cobra subgroup that we have never known about before and feels very in line with sort of how the like action figure product layout or the hierarchy of Cobra could work, which is that Major Blood has his own group of, let's say, hired mercenaries, because Major Blood is a mercenary. He's a soldier for hire. And they have costumes that are like his. Help me out here. Are these sort of based on his animated appearance and not a classified appearance?
Yeah, so it's basically his V1 costume without the eye patch and the robot arm. So we've got this modern day classified reinvention and updating of his costume. And then you've got that classic costume, which is, you know, left in the past. But actually, they found this use for it and making use of this really cool, iconic costume as well. And it's in some ways almost what you might happen as a child with your toys, that if you were to have a character and then they make a V2 version of that character, you've still got two toys now. But you want to have them both in your game. So maybe one of them is like now a different character. I could entirely see that as happening with like Major Blood. Like, okay, I've got two Major Blood characters. One of them is not Major Blood. He's the Bloodhound and he's going to be, you know, Major Blood's assistant.
I don't say this as a joke. I say this with a big smile. I fully expect now in a year there to be a 3-pack from Hasbro of classified or maybe a reaction. A Super 7, a sort of classified or more detailed Major Blood with two guys who have more generic faces and don't have eye patches and have slightly simpler costumes. And it's the Major Blood and the Bloodhounds 3-pack. And this is really fun because, you know, G.I. Joe toy fans like to troop build, because in the story, we expect there to be these additional sort of soldiers and armies. You know, it's like maybe it's Green Shirts, or maybe it's the 1982 Cobra Soldier, or maybe it's all the technicians who work in the Terrordrome, who you briefly see at the beginning of the animated movie, but who are sort of never otherwise identified. But surely you'd need guys to like fix a little jet and then get beat up by Pythona. So this page turn it's an exciting, like, oh no, the Joes are outnumbered, the Joes are in trouble. Oh my goodness, what an exciting visual with these bad guys coming. And oh hey, I know that helicopter. Oh, hey, this red is really striking. Oh hey, what a cool name. It just sort of like doubles and triples and quintuples on itself in terms of G.I. Joe meaning and potential. So really fun. Also, I always take note when you see a bunch of bad guys, like Cobra soldiers, and like in the cartoon, it was always Caucasian, Cobra soldiers, Cobra Vipers, except for the one episode where one specific Cobra is a black guy. And here, the guy on the right is definitely not a white guy. And I just appreciate that little bit of variety. So very exciting double page splash. Two pages later, this is the last thing I'll point out that's great about Jordi Belair's work in this comic. On the bottom of page 16, there's this panel that says boom, and Rock and Roll and Clutch are getting thrown back. And this is not Tom Riley doing the Frank Miller Sin City style of art, but if you need sort of a dumb description, that's what it is. And Jordi Belair does something cool here where she takes all of the black in this panel and she puts it through some kind of filter so that it looks like a third generation photocopy, like a copy of a color copy of a color copy, or it looks like it's got a bunch of like video noise, like it's from an old videotape. And it doesn't sort of mean anything specific. It's just to add to this idea that there's this sound and this physical shockwave of force and violence, just to make the sort of hit of the panel look and feel different for the reader. And then she does it again really subtly, exactly two pages later on the final panel of page 18, when Major Blood's mechanical hand hits Duke from behind. And Belair very subtly takes the color, all of the color in the panel, and slightly offsets it below and behind the black inking to add to this idea of like a shockwave, a vibration that Duke's getting rattled. It's sort of like, it's not quite that the color's being sort of punched out of the panel, but the color's being rattled around in the panel, the way that Duke's brain is being rattled around in his skull. And when you see it, and then you compare it to the rest of the page, which is colored in sort of a quote normal way, it is a really nice, subtle accentuation.
That's a great description. Yeah, it's a kind of, it's a really chaotic, kinetic scene, this kind of invasion into the detention center, and a lot of the power of that is through the color. We kind of worked back, started at the back of the issue three, and then started and then before we flip back to the front of issue two. So we've kind of covered this last sequence, but it's an interesting kind of then cliffhanger, definitely closing out the issue on a, oh, what's going to happen next as this battle rages between the Bloodhounds, Clutch and Rock and Roll, with the Baroness leveling her gun at Duke, and she implies that he has a bounty on his head, a bounty perhaps that she might want to collect. So
she's not a good character. She's not trustworthy after all. He shouldn't have let her out. But there's that great bit of guilt where the four Joes are running, and she says, "They'll kill me, right? They'll kill me unless you let me out, and then I can help you escape. At least help me escape." A quick observation and then a quick question. My observation is not an error detected, but I'm sort of wondering, in this issue, when they're in prison on page 8, Duke says Hawk's name while he's talking to the Baroness. And it's, it's something like, "I should have gone to Hawk," or "maybe I'll go to Hawk again." And I thought, would he say that name to this high value prisoner? Even though he knows who she is, and she probably knows who Hawk is, or maybe they've all got some backstory and she definitely knows who Hawk is. But I wanted to ask you, did you think that was Duke saying something sort of top secret that he shouldn't be saying?
I didn't even pick up on it at the time, to be honest. So it didn't leave me with a strong impression.
Okay.
But now that you've pointed it out, I guess it's probably doing a couple of things. Maybe Duke is being a little bit sloppy with loose lips sink ships, but maybe Hawk is a code name and shouldn't be expected to be known by the Baroness, or maybe I guess he's in a pressurized situation and not thinking completely rational. But the other thing I think this is doing is it's sort of it's a message almost for the readers of kind of trying to show us that Duke is still rational. He's not completely split from some of the ideals. So maybe that journey then back home to G.I. Joe and the working with and for Hawk isn't quite such a swing. He's still thinks that Hawk is probably a good guy and probably there for him, and that maybe if he did just go back to him, that they could find a way through things.
And then my question, or my sort of comment for you, sort of for our listeners, was before we started recording, you had noted that I think you had a different amount of story and satisfaction you got from Duke number one compared to Duke number two. Mm-hmm. And so here we are talking about Duke two and three together. And then you also reminded yourself that Duke number one was an oversized first issue.
Yeah.
How do you feel about the amount of story happening in issue two and three?
So yeah, definitely. Duke one was oversized. It introduced us to this new world and lots of new concepts, and it was a very exciting issue. Issue two sort of left me slightly flat, just because it seemed like it was over too quickly. It seemed like a much smaller story in terms of that chase and capture. Duke three, I think, opened the world up a bit more, and for whatever reason, I found Duke 3 much more exciting. Maybe it's just bigger stakes, more characters, the introduction of Major Blood, who's such a cool character. So definitely still enjoying the whole series overall. But for me, it was probably Duke 1, Duke 3, Duke 2 would be the order of my enjoyment.
This is why I think, in addition to issue number 1's being double-sized, I think issue number 2's should be double-sized, particularly when it's G.I. Joe, and probably every issue.
Okay, so let's wrap up, shall we? A quick...
Eight! I'm giving Duke 2 and 3 an 8. They are gorgeous. They're fun. A lot of things that are familiar. A lot of exciting twists. I'm worried about Duke. We didn't even say it. He got shot in the leg by Blood, and this is in the same issue, or this is one issue after he got some bullets removed anyway.
Yeah.
8.
Yeah, 8 sounds on average about right. Yeah, maybe 2 was a 7.5, 3 is an 8.5. Let's average it out at 8. Great. I'm really looking forward to seeing more Duke next time. And yeah, we will be continuing to cover the latest issues as they come out. G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, issue 305 will be coming out soon, as is Cobra Commander, issue 3. So we'll be covering that very shortly too. So we'll cover Cobra Commander issues 2 and 3 together. And we'll also be dipping our toes back into the heady days of Devil's Due in the early 2000s, as well as more besides. If you are new to our podcast, you can find out more about us at talkingjoe.co.uk. That's the website that links you to all of the places like our Facebook group, our Twitter account, Instagram, the voicemail facility that's at the bottom of the page. And we've even got a link to Patreon there, patreon.com/talkingjoe. A big thanks to our backers: Richard, Sam, Jay, Bill, Christopher, Justin, Rob, Brian, Shane, Ryan, and Simon, and Chris, our latest backer. They are all getting early access to episodes as well as some exclusive content. Tim, where can you find me when you're not terrorizing the world with your authentic Australian accent?
I can find you at talkingjoe.co.uk and also the Talking Joe group page on Facebook.
Did I say where can you find me?
You did.
Okay. Where can people find you then?
Video essays about TV and film at my YouTube page at Atomic Abe. My brick and mortar comic book shop in Somerville, Massachusetts is Hub Comics. And I write about G.I. Joe at my blog, arealamericanbook.com.
Very good. And with all that out of the way, I think we're done. But remember that...
Nobody beats Talking Joe, an international podcast!
Ooh.
I'm going to be sad when this miniseries is over and Tom Riley goes off to do something else. But I'm sure whoever draws the next two minis and whatever comes after that will be fitting and great. But yeah. I'm already crossing my fingers that, you know, Tom Riley draws Codename G.I. Joe or does some like special missions issue with Hanma or something. So handsome.
Excellent stuff. Laters, everyone.